No matter what the season or the weather, insects, of course, are always around us. And you know what? They're fascinating creatures. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletier is an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, recently retired as head of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on campus. And Phil, always great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Nice to be here.
We've got lots of things we can talk about. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a photo of an insect you'd like to see if Phil can identify. Please feel free to shoot that up on my Facebook page. To get to the Facebook page, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and there will be. Been a lot of concern about the decline of monarch butterflies in the past few years, Phil, and the drought in 2012 seemed to kind of set them back, I think. How's this year been?
Well, you know, it's only a small piece of the pie, but I think I have definitely seen more monarchs both earlier this season and now that we're going through the migratory phase, congregations of monarchs, and we're getting those same kind of reports. And so last year, where the first one didn't seem to get in the state until June, and you just saw nothing in September, was out for a walk the other day, and there was this little prairie established area, maybe about the size of this room here, and there must have been 25 monarchs sitting there resting.
Oh, cool.
And it's been a while since I've seen that. So slightly optimistic in the sense that we're seeing higher numbers in Wisconsin, definitely we have in the last 3 or 4 years. But unfortunately, you know, it's a much bigger picture than that. And so until we get the overwintering populations down in Mexico and they see what the densities are like, we won't know really what kind of recovery, if any, is going on. But as I said, the good news for Wisconsin, it's been a much better monarch year than we've seen in a while.
Do all the monarchs migrate, or do some of them stick around here? Or are they?
No, I mean, basically, there's a population on the West Coast that goes down into the Baja Peninsula, and then we have the population here that goes into the mountains in north of Mexico City. And you start seeing the migration probably about the last week of August or so, and it will continue on as long as the weather will allow. In fact, I saw one this morning as I was walking in.
And hopefully the sign of good things to come. I mean, can we extrapolate anything?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is different weather patterns. You know, that's what hurt us in the state last year. And again, there's lots of complicating factors. The lack of milkweed plants like it was 20, 30 years ago, and a lot of people equate that to herbicide use and the like. A bigger concern, too, has been the overwintering populations in Mexico because of logging and other things. That niche is being altered, and we're fearful. So as I said, there's a bunch of things going on, but as I said, it was nice to see this. It's been a while since I've seen those kind of congregations. I even ran home and got my camera to get some pictures. And we're getting those same kind of reports around the state from people who are paying attention.
Yeah, we actually have a Facebook comment from Sandy who says it's been a great year for her for monarchs. She said, I raised over 100 monarchs from eggs to butterfly this year, and that compares to only 12 last year. I've been incorporating various types of milkweed into my garden landscape over the past 5 years for a safe habitat for them. And I've also noted there seems to be much more milkweed in the ditches around northeast Wisconsin Lakeshore. Not sure if this was intentional or not, but keep it coming. I also was privileged to witness their migration path from Kewaunee County to Manitowoc County.
Yeah, with the lake there, you often get like a corridor, and so it isn't unusual to see the populations kind of concentrate. And again, if you're ever lucky enough to see on a nice, warm, sunny afternoon these congregations, as I said, it really is stunning, and it's something that's well worth, if you know there's an area they're congregating, to go out on a nice day and observe it.
So I guess Sandy is a pretty good advertisement for, you know, helping the monarchs along.
Yeah. So a lot of people, and I've noticed, too, that people have purposely put milkweed into their garden and the like.
Yeah.
Yesterday, went again out on a walk in part of the University Research Park, there are some prairie remnants that they've put in. Lots of milkweed in there, no sign of activity. And so I think that's what disappoints people, is even if you put the milkweed out there, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get them coming through. But without the milkweed, we know they're in trouble. So it's a very good thought to put plants out there, make them available. I was lucky enough. I had one caterpillar that we reared out They were on our butterfly weed.
Ah.
And so my grandson got to see his first monarch, which he named Freddy. So now we see Freddy flying all around. But it was interesting because I did see adults in the backyard after that, even on the butterfly weed. I assume they laid eggs, but I never saw another larvae. So.
Oh. Neil in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Neil. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I have a problem with yellow jackets. They build their nest above the soffit in my house in an area where I cannot see them. And I know they have a lot of activities going in and out. It's in a garden area, and I'm really concerned.
Sure.
My question here, is there a way, you know, I can get at them without having to do a major construction? Or B, would they come back next year if the winter, let's say, get rid of them?
Yeah, the winter will guarantee, by the 1st of November, they will have died out. What has probably happened is there is a seam somewhere up in the eaves or under the siding that they've got access to, and what they have constructed is a paper wasp nest in a void somewhere. And I guess what I would weigh here is, you know, if it was right in front of your front door where there was a high probability that you'd be running into them as they're coming and going, it's well worth treating. But if we've gotten this far in the season and you're not getting them coming in the house and you can't see the access point, it may not be worth trying to take the risk of treating. What I would suggest if you had to treat it is to use a dust, not a spray. And it's best to dust, maybe about 6:30, 7 o'clock at night or right away on a nice cool morning. And you dust the opening they're coming and going from. And then as they move through it, the dust will take care of them. But the problem here is if you don't know where it is, you know, to try to observe that, to have to get up on a ladder and all those things. And as I said, the worst thing one could do is to plug that opening before they are taken care of. So, you know, we know what will happen is they will starve to death. Then next year, you know, when it's in the spring, you can go up there and observe and see if you can see where that opening is. And then caulk screen, whatever. Just in this, they don't reuse the old nests, but if it's a decent habitat, sometimes you will find one will come back to the area and try to establish another nest. But as I said, if you've gotten this far along and they're not causing you any problems, if it's, you know, up way 10 feet off the ground or the like, that's probably high enough that it's less likely to cause you or if you have pets or whatnot any concerns.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. You know, one of the unpleasant things, unfortunately, about this time of the year is they yellow jackets do get aggressive.
Yeah. So it's a scavenging. You know, so yellow jackets are predators by nature. And as we get in the late summer, they have a lot of mouths to feed, and there honestly isn't a lot of food. And so they become scavengers on sugar and on protein. So we have trouble at times. People are picking grapes. They're in the grapes because as the grapes ripen, the high sugar contacts attract them. We also find any food or drink. And so farmers, markets, outdoor restaurants, places that there is continually a food source, the yellow jackets pick up on that. And so they come in. And again, I have found back in the 70s, the German yellow jacket moved in the state and the number of stings went up. Some summers by tenfold because it's an urban critter, very likely to become aggressive as early as the 1st of August. This year, it was about the 1st of September. So the yellow jacket problems are up, but not like they were in what I would consider a bad year. But this won't settle down for at least another 3 to 4 weeks. And so they said you have to be careful eating or drinking outdoors in that if they show up, they will compete with you with food. And, you know, the problem is if one's sitting on a pop can, you don't observe it, you bring it up, you get stung. And so it isn't so much that they're overly aggressive as they're in places that they're likely to have a close contact with people. And that's where we tend to see the stings, as is people out mowing the lawn. You know, you don't see these ground nesters. You go over, it's an old gopher burrow or something similar that they've nested in. And boy, all hell heck breaks loose because they are very defensive if the nests are threatened.
I've had firsthand experience with that with a lawnmower, and I don't want to repeat that.
I mean, it can get to the point because there can be literally 100, 200 wasps coming out. The multiple stings can be really life-threatening, as is if you swallow one and get even if you're not allergic, if you swallow one, the swelling of your throat can be serious. And as I said, so you really do have to take care. And, you know, I know this dates me, but, you know, back as a kid, we didn't have these issues that I remembered. But once this German yellow jacket moved in, it really intensified the problems dramatically. And the kind of complaints coming in, it is a moderate year. I won't say it's a good year for yellow jackets, but their numbers are definitely up compared to what we've seen.
And then how do they spend their winter? Do they?
So they produce new queens in the fall. They produce males for the first time. Those queens mate, and then they'll crawl under a rock or some other kind of sheltered habitat, spend the winter. In the spring of the year, they wake up, and then they're out searching. And she basically starts everything from scratch by herself. But in the peak of the year, you can have 250, 400 worker yellow jackets in a colony. My guess right now, if you were to monitor populations, that they're in decline already. Mm-hmm. But is until we get two or three hard freezes, I don't think we're out of the yellow jacket season.
And somebody wanted to know if they were pollinators. Are they pollinators?
To some degree. You will see them nectar a bit, and so they do collect pollen that way. Are they important pollinators? No. But are they important predators on various pest insects? Yes.
Okay.
You know, as I said, they'll go out and collect caterpillars and other things to feed their young. And what we think happens is, again, the numbers of natural prey go down, but yet they still can find protein and sugar in what we eat, and that's where the competition starts.
Laura in Madison, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Oh, hi, guys. I can't believe your timing. It's wonderful. A couple days back, on the north side of our house, there were all these winged little tiny ants coming up from our foundation, just between the house and the driveway, and they were crawling up the side of the house. I posted some pictures on the Facebook page for you. I need to know. Now there's no evidence of them at all. Mm-hmm. And I need to know if it's something I should treat or if they're gone or if they're down in my foundation making a wreck or what.
So you witnessed a swarm. And different species swarm at different times. In the late summer, field ants, cornfield ants, and occasionally citronella, or what are sometimes called larger yellow ants, swarm. And my first guess is they might be citronellas because it's an ant that you only see when it swarms, and then you don't see it at any other time. The workers don't come in for food. They just kind of behave themselves, and if that was the case, really no need to be concerned. Field ants typically don't come in for food, so those are another ones that you kind of argue, why would you really have to treat? Sometimes the cornfield ants come in, and they particularly have a sweet tooth. They love to get on spilled sugar and pop and those kind of things. And if that was the case, that you had a history of small little red ants running around the house and causing problems, then I'd say, okay, well, you could consider to treat. And now you know where the nest is. It's in that foundation area, except in order to get success, you somehow have to get the product down into where they came from. And for these kind of ground nesters, I often would suggest to use a wooden dowel or something to make two or three channels and then treat into it. But my first take on this is it is not needed. You didn't mention that you had previous ant problems. And as I said, if it's something like the yellow ants, when they swarm, other than letting you know where they are, they don't hurt anything. And for that reason, I don't think they're really worth doing much with.
Well, actually, you know, every summer we do have tiny little ants in our kitchen right near where that foundation.
Okay.
But they're completely different looking ants. The ones that come into the kitchen are minuscule little ants that we can never figure out what they're eating. Mm-hmm. These ants were larger and they had wings.
Right. But see, that's typical. So you say, technically you could call them kings and queens, but they're the reproductives. And it's often common that the reproductive stage of a given ant are much bigger and may even be different colored. In fact, the males and females are often different size, but if it's got wings, you know it's a reproductive, whereas the wingless ants are the workers. One other option you have, you know, and honestly, because we're not 100% sure that the ants you're seeing in the kitchen are the same ones that were swarming, is to bait them. And what I suggest in these cases, you know, if you catch the ants, you can send them into the diagnostic lab and PJ can identify them. And if we know what the ant is, it's easier to direct people the right way. But if you put a little bit of honey or something sweet on a piece of wax paper and you put a little cooking oil and keep them separated by, you know, a couple, 3 inches, you put it out where you see the ant activity, you see which one they're showing an interest in, then you can go to the hardware store and buy an appropriate bait, some for sweet feeding ants, some for protein feeding ants. Often the very little ants have a real sweet tooth, and so there's even a boric acid bait called taro that you can buy at the grocery store. And the idea with the baits is you put them out, you keep giving the ants as bait as long as they have an interest, but they pick it up and feed it to the queen and each other, and that thereby controls the colony. And the advantage of the bait is you don't need to know where they're coming from. You just need to accept the bait, but you have to match the bait, you know, and as I said, so if you see activity again, that's what I would suggest. Try to find out what their food preference is and use that to your advantage.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri about the fascinating world of insects. And you can join in, 1-800-642-1234. You can post a photo. We've got a bunch of photos on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can do that. Or call at 1-800-642-1234. We have one photo up. I don't know if you can see it, Phil, from Jeff, who is wondering, these curious beetles in the seed pods of his flower.
His flowers. Okay. So those are adult weevils, and weevils are a family of beetles. Many of them are seed feeders. And what happens is they use this beak to feed into the flower as it's developing, or the young seed, turn around, drop their eggs, and then the grubs feed on the seed. So they've completed their life cycle here. Unfortunately, when you're growing plants for seed, these are major pests because they can take a high 70, 80, 90% of the seeds in some cases. Many of them are very host specific. So the one on cardinal flowers, you wouldn't expect to necessarily bother any other plants in the garden. The problem is if you're trying to grow for seed, you have to stop them when the females are laying eggs. That's the start of this whole process. Whereas if we're this late in the game, as they said, all we've got are the adults emerging. In some cases, they spend the winter as adults in the litter, and then they start the whole process over in the spring. So some sanitation will help a little bit. But as far as any serious control, as they said, I would be considering spraying. And, you know, for the average garden, I don't think that's something that has to be done.
Yeah.
As I said, it's more for people that are producing plants for, you know, prairie nurseries and whatnot. Sometimes they have to go pretty aggressively so they can get some seed to harvest. But in this case, I don't think that would be needed.
Matthew in Menominee, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry and Phil. I have an abundance of the household moth, which is about from wingtip to wingtip. It's about, I don't know, an inch or three quarters of an inch wide. And if you have to dispatch of them, they kind of turn to powder. So
do they have any color pattern? Or the other question, have you seen any webbing in any of your food products or pet food?
I haven't seen any webbing, and they do not vary in color.
They're
all that kind of khaki gray, that really mundane gray color.
And is there any little darker tips on the wingtips at all?
There could be.
Okay. Where I'm fishing here. Now, the first thing is one of the curious things of this year, I'm talking to PJ, and I noticed the same thing, is we've been getting a lot of complaints of great big cutworm moths in people's houses.
Hmm.
And it turns out to be the copper-winged underwing, which is a moth that I've never seen have this kind of ear. But that's an outside thing that just kind of gets in, and that's a big moth.
Yeah.
Whereas typically when somebody's got fluttering things in the house, they're usually either Mediterranean flower moth, Indian meal moth, or almond moth. All three of those are dry good pests. You know, you see them in bird seed, you see them in pet food, you see them in dry goods like cereal and nut meats and dried fruit, but then also potpourri. And in fact, I'm giving a talk this Wednesday for a group, and they want to know about common household insects. And so I definitely have to address these kind of critters that you see coming in on food products. And the problem is, you find little white worms, which are the larval stage, and often those white worms will web things together. So if you open the can or box of Bisquick, you see all this webbing and worms, and that's where the fire is. That's what you have to address and throw out what's infested. And then you got to, because these things are flying around for a while, you've got to make sure they have not access to other food products. And so, as I said, think about anything that's dried plant material. That could even include tea. As I said, potpourri, dried roses, I mean, all that other odd stuff, and search that out. Because what we always tell people, you can't really spray for this problem because it's in the food. And that's where the problem has to be addressed. So it's a sanitation issue. Oftentimes you get a little bit of a hint. If most of them showed up in the bathroom, you'd say, well, you know, I don't keep food in the bathroom. That's where I worry about potpourri or something odd like that. Or if most are in the basement, that means the source is in the basement. It might be an old Christmas wreath made out of walnuts. You know, yeah, just kind of odd stuff like that. But it takes a detective to kind of solve this
one. Yeah. There you go. Good luck.
PSI on it. Can I ask one more quick question?
Okay.
Is it the yellow jackets that do the mud nests?
No.
Alongside buildings?
No. I mean, yellow jackets make a gray paper wasp, very light type of nest. There are mud daubers, which are basically spider predators in most cases, and they construct these tubes, but they're technically called a solitary wasp in that there's not a queen and a bunch of workers, and it gets bigger and bigger over time. There are individuals that provision each one of these cells. And the general rule is if the critters are solitary types, they're far less aggressive because there's no nest to defend, whereas bumblebees, honeybees, and yellow jackets that live in these big colonies, those are the ones that we have the biggest problem with because, as I said, they're very defensive if the nest is threatened in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. David in Sabin, your turn. Hi, David.
Well, hello. I was treated to a wonderful sight. It might have been 3 or 4 weeks ago in rural Wisconsin. I saw thousands of dragonflies flitting about maybe 5 or 10 feet off the ground, feeding, I guess. And I just thought, oh, it's been a hatch. But somebody said this past weekend that dragonflies sometimes migrate. Could they have been preparing for a migration?
Could be. You'd have to see which species, because some migrate, some don't. And we see this phenomenon at times of congregations of dragonflies. You know, if they were concentrating in an area, my first take, especially if it was a later afternoon, is that there might be some ant swarming going on, because there are just literally millions of little tiny flying insects up in the air, and that's what the dragonflies are eating. And so it's kind of a food-feeding frenzy that you will see. Typically, you don't expect the migrations to be in flocks or groups, but that's not to say these kinds of observations haven't been seen before in the late summer, and that's been thrown out. But what would have been interesting is, you know, if you could have got a good enough look to see if it was just one kind of dragonfly. There have even been times when it's been a mixture of species, which is really quite an interesting phenomenon to see. But it, you know, hard to predict, but we do get these reports. It is not that unusual to get these reports.
It isn't a hatch of the dragonflies then, but perhaps a hatch of prey species.
Yes, that's what I would expect more, right, because they're not going to hang around unless there's a reason, especially if you saw them kind of hovering and flitting back and forth. You see the same phenomenon with birds sometimes when you get these swarms, because I mean, there's so many flying insects, it almost looks like a cloud at times coming off the soil. And as I said, you find birds will come in there, especially flying insect feeders, and just basically a nice, good source of protein in a very short period of time.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate it. Claire in Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Claire. Oops. Hold on. Let me try that again. Oops. Claire, I'm sorry. I just got you on now. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Okay, hi Larry, and I'm pleased to speak to the insect king.
All right.
If you don't mind, I'd like to go back to the monarchs for a couple minutes. I'm so interested in their migration. How high up are they flying when they migrate, and how do they avoid the winds and currents when they're trying to head south?
Okay,
well, or north.
you can find them. It wouldn't surprise me to find them 300-400 feet, although typically I think of monarchs as being kind of a little bit lower migrator. In a trick, and I'm not sure this is with monarchs, I know it happens with other insects, and it would make a lot of sense, is temperature has a lot. Now, you don't see monarchs, first of all, trying to migrate on a cloudy, windy, cold day. And we have some insects that if it's nice and sunny and the temperature is above 60 degrees, they will get up into the wind currents, which is typically in the spring, southerly air flows. And so that's how they migrate north. Well, it doesn't make as much sense in the fall because, of course, if you've got a northerly wind, which would be very advantageous to migrate south, it's typically a colder wind. So I'm not so sure, other than knowing that there is this temperature factor that's involved. And a lot of times, if it's real windy, I just find that they lay low because they're not strong flyers against a strong wind. typically what you see the more activity is when you get nice sunny days that are a little bit calmer, and I think that tends to help them quite a bit because, as I said, at least they can make some progress in the right direction.
There you go. Thank you very much, Claire, for calling. Dave in Muscadet, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I just moved to Muscadet, and we have put up oriole feeders and hummingbird feeders, and we have this large black bee that just eats this stuff up. They chase the birds away. I've never seen this bee. They don't have a narrow middle like a wasp or a hornet, so I figure it's a bee. They're about 3/4 of an inch to an inch long.
Are they real fuzzy? Can you tell? I mean,
Yeah, I don't get too close to them because they're kind of aggressive when you bother them when they're feeding. Mm-hmm. But yeah, kind of fuzzy. And a time or two, I thought I saw a white or a yellowish spot on them too.
Yeah, see, that's what I was trying to fish, if it was something like a big carpenter bee, which is like a giant bumblebee, but it has a little different patterns on it. The other thing when you get into this is, you know, ball-faced hornets. Are large, about an inch long. They have this kind of whitish patch on the face where the name comes from, and these are technically a paper wasp, but they're also scavengers. You know, and of the two, I would be more likely to expect the bald-faced hornets to be stealing the food rather than bumblebees.
Okay, now, would the hornets have a narrow middle? Because these look like they're all pretty solid throughout.
If you had one under the microscope, you would see, but generally from looking at them, you don't see the constriction like you would on some of the thread-waisted wasps and the like. And again, the main distinguishing thing is if you got somewhat close to them is, you know, hornets really, although they have a few black bristles on the body, you definitely wouldn't describe them as fuzzy. It's interesting, if you ever look at a bee up close, the hairs are branched like feathers, and that's what gives them that very, you know, fuzzy appearance in most cases. And so, as I said, I'm more likely to expect the bald-faced hornets to be scavenging like this. You know, some of this has to do with hummingbird feeder designs. Some of them are prone to spill some sugar, and if that is out there and available, the yellow jackets and whatnot will come in and attack it.
They chase the hummingbirds away.
Right, and I know there are some other feeder designs that are such that really are far less likely to have the leakage, and if you don't have the leakage, you don't have as much problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so, and this carpenter bee, what are they like?
Honestly, they're relatives of the bumblebee. They construct their nests in wood, and so you get these tubes. And sometimes the problem is they're in people's soffits and other wood that's starting to soften up. But they collect pollen and nectar like a bee should. And again, because it's away from the nest, even though sometimes you observe something that you think is aggressive behavior, usually it's more of a curiosity about them. And I don't find them to be overly aggressive away from the nest. An interesting side point is carpenter bees have become more common during my career. I typically consider them more of a southern creature, even though we have some native carpenter bees. And this is one of those things that the milder winters, I think, are allowing them to move north. I definitely get more complaints about carpenter bees now than I did 30 years ago. So
there we go. Thank you again, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Myra in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Myra.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have like a little farmette that I live on. I have about 150 apple trees and about 1/4 acre of raspberries. And I have, it looks like a wasp. It's real skinny in the middle. It's black. It has 2 white stripes on the hind quarter, and it has like a white face on the mask on its face. And it only eats raspberries. And it's really aggressive. I've been stung several times picking raspberries, but it's never in the apple orchard. What is it?
Again, I'm guessing because I can think about 5 things that make that description. But we get a lot of complaints on ground nesting and above ground nesting yellow jackets that scavenge on overly ripe fruit. It's a real problem because they can be coming in from 100 or 200 yards away. The nest may not be very obvious, especially if it's a ground nester. You know, they're usually pretty well behaved until the fruit starts to be ready to be picked, because then the sugar contents are high and then it's worth their, and literally the point, in bad years, they will be chewing on the fruit in front of people, you know, something that's thin skinned.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, where there runs the risk when you're in there picking at things, of picking one up in the hand and getting zapped. And it's a very painful experience. So unfortunately,
yes.
You know, there's not an easy answer here other than, you know, you talk about sanitation in that, you know, berries that are too damaged and the like for you to want to harvest, still clean them up and get them out of there. Because the more overly ripe stuff you've got on the ground and in the area, the more you're drawing in. The problem with apples, among other things, is apples don't develop those kind of sugar levels, I think, that attract these things. Plus, they're thicker skinned. I have seen yellow jackets attack windfall apples if something else has made a hole to begin with, you know, and then they can get access.
I have yellow jackets in the apples like crazy, but they almost seem like they get drunk. When they eat a fermented apple, they just crawl around. They're not aggressive like the other ones are.
Yeah, yeah. No, if you get a chance to get a decent picture of one, or you know, one dies and whatnot, you can always, you know, send it down to get a proper ID. But as I said, this scavenging behavior, it's not unusual. In some years, worse than others. And as we were talking right away when the show started, it seems that the yellow jacket problems have really kind of picked up. And usually, you know, if you got earlier bearing berries, it's less of a problem because they don't start the scavenging until we get in the late summer and early fall.
And Myra, you might want to go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, because Mary sent us a couple of photos of an insect that only gets after her raspberries. So we got two shots.
That's a real interesting picture to me, because the critter is a metallic wood boring beetle. Buprestid is what we call the family.
Oh.
And I never would have guessed Buprestids. Now, they won't sting. And again, I think, like many things, they're probably trying to take advantage of the high sugar content. But this is a group, as I said, I never would have expected to see in ripe fruit, because it's a wood borer. I mean, it's all about attacking dead trees and its grubs being inside that. And I don't normally associate them with overly ripe things, even the adults feeding. So that's quite an interesting picture, and that's a first for me.
Ah, all right. Well, there you go.
Well, I did catch one. Can I send it in somewhere?
Sure.
Or bring it to Madison? My daughter goes to school in Madison, so I'm up there quite a bit.
Sure. Whatever is more convenient. The nice thing about where the diagnostic lab is located, it's right across from the Babcock Ice Cream Parlor on the west end of campus. And so you can have...
Okay, so right where that is.
Okay, so right across, it's in Russell Labs. The office is 237 Russell Labs.
Okay.
And P.J. Leash is now the director of the lab, and he can identify it for you. Or you could send it in. The address is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. And the university zip is 53706. And just send it to the insect lab, and P.J. will get it.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Myra. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Mike in Waukesha. Let's go to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I enjoy your shows.
Thank you.
I'm kind of beating the same drum a lot of the other callers have about the question with bees, wasps, or yellow jackets. I was over at my mother's home doing a little maintenance, and I noticed that where her brick house, where the bricks actually meet the soffit, these little critters are crawling up in the mortar cracks to get up in the soffit. So I haven't actually seen the nest to identify that. And the insects themselves are about two-thirds of an inch in length, I would guess, and they do not look fuzzy to me like a typical bee does.
Mm-hmm.
But yet they're not a super narrow-waisted.
No. But the question is, do you see just an occasional one, or do you see quite a bit of traffic going on when you were...
Well, when I've been outside the house doing the maintenance and not even, you know, within 20 feet of it, there's a pretty good swarm of activity.
Okay. Yeah, see, what I was fishing for there is when you get weep holes and whatnot in masonry, there's other kinds of critters that will get in there, but it'll be one here, one there, and that's nothing to worry about.
No, there's 15, 20 in the air at a time at least. Around that opening area.
Okay, so, you know, we're kind of where we were with the earlier caller in that you kind of have to assess what's going on, because they will naturally die out within 4 to 5 weeks. And so if it's an area of a lot of traffic and the like, then you still got 4 or 5 weeks of potentially getting in trouble.
Traffic for people. I'm just wondering if this is... If you would think that it's not a bee where it's going to come back to the same...
No. The only critter that overwinters as a colony in our state is the honeybee.
Okay.
And honeybees, although occasionally they'll nest in an attic or a similar space. You know, it's a constant high number all the time. Spring, fall, doesn't matter. Whereas what happens with these yellow jackets, when they start with a single queen, often their numbers don't get high enough to get your attention until we're well into the mid to late summer. So this is quite typical to see all this activity on sunny days and the like. Again, as we mentioned, if it's a place that needs to be dealt with, I find, you know, if a nest is out in the open and you can see it, the aerosol wasp sprays you get at the hardware store are exceptional. Some of them will shoot 20 feet. But we don't get good results when you use those kind of products for these kind of in the ground or in a wall nest, because we don't know where the nest is versus where they're coming and going. Instead, what we tend to find is getting a product that is a powder, and you dust it in the entrance. And sometimes, you know, people use an old mustard bottle or, you know, there are devices that sometimes you can get at the hardware store made for shooting these bulb dusters and the like. But when you dust that entrance, and it really, to me, is quite important to dust it either right in the morning before they become active or in the evening, let's say close to sunset, because at that time, everybody's there and you've got them surrounded. They're all going to have to come through the dust eventually, and it will kill them. The problem with treating in the middle of the day is the workers that are out foraging for food come back, and honestly, the products have quite a bit of repellency to them. And so they don't want to cross there. So now you got a bunch of angry wasps flying around the outside of the house for 2 or 3 days, and that's not good.
Oh.
So as I said, to me, the powder is extremely important and the timing is extremely important if you've got to treat the nest. And as we talked earlier, the worst mistake people can make is not treat the nest and seal the opening, figuring I'll get those little devils. And what you'll find is they'll come out through light fixtures and other sources in the house. And again, their attitude will not be good. And so I'd rather, in many cases, let them just go naturally rather than, as I said, worry about sealing. But I can absolutely assure you, they don't reuse the nest. They don't survive the winter. And those are 2 points to your advantage. On the other hand, you know, next time you're working around in the spring, early summer, if you can seal up that opening just so that in the future nobody will ever get access to it again.
There you go, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, as we talk the world of insects with him. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or join the many people who have sent photos in on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you, regardless of how you do it. And, Phil, we have something from Andrea, a couple of photos. She says, it's my understanding this is a rare moth.
It definitely is a moth. I would not Looks consider big. It rare.
Okay.
It's a bumblebee mimic. It is technically in the hawk or sphinx moth group. This one is called the snowberry clearwing. And what's kind of unique about it is many of the scales are not found on the forewing, and so it has these kind of openings, and that's why it looks like a bumblebee. Flies during the day. The caterpillar, the most common one, feeds on honeysuckle, which is a pretty common plant here. It's a neat creature, though. Many people are just amazed when they see them. If you observe the way they fly, it is different than a bumblebee. You know, it really is more like a miniature hummingbird. But to get that good a picture is not easy. So
no, it's a nice photo.
It's nice creature. And there is another species of clearwings in the state that we see, too. But as I said, interesting group, and technically the larvae are hornworms because they have little spines, single spine on the back of the abdomen.
Mary in La Crosse has something. Mary, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. My question for Phil is about mealybugs and scale. My neighbor, I have a handicapped neighbor, and she's only had one plant in her house, and it was a peace lily. And a couple of years ago, it died from overwatering, and because it was a gift at her daughter's funeral, she felt badly about it. I went to the greenhouse. They ordered one exactly like that. It was a variegated spathiphyllum, which is unusual. Anyway, and spathiphyllums ordinarily aren't subject to pests at all, but she called me about a week and a half ago, and said that her plant was all sticky, and I went, oh, and went over and took a look, and it was absolutely covered with scale, and it's been in her house 2 years. She has no other plants. Hardly anybody ever even goes into her house. And I have some really nice large specimen plants that I had just brought into my house. I put them out often in the summertime to get rained on. They had just been rained on. But the first time I went over to her apartment, I did touch the plant. And then I came back home and dug out my plant material, including my Master Gardener entomology stuff that I'm just now looking at now, and went back over there again. Then when I came back home, I took off my clothes, I hopped into the shower, but my question is, beyond all this story here, how in the world would she get scale? Because the nymphs are under the little house, and how in the world, and the greenhouse, they were puzzled also.
Yeah, I mean, the time frame is quite long, but basically the indoor scales we get are tropical plant creatures. And so you don't expect migration from outside under typical situations. And the only thing I can think of is that there was only one or two scales. We went now through a handful of generations. They finally become numerous to get people's attention. But I just can't think of any other scenario. Because if the plant came in clean, there is no way without another plant. You technically can spread them on watering cans and the like, but they're really not overly aggressive there. You know, as far as moving, so you come to visit and help her out and then go back home, the chance of you carrying them is really minuscule because they need to stay on the plants. They're not about migrating around much. Some scales we know use birds and other things as ways for moving from plant to plant. That would not be a factor for an indoor plant. So as I said, I just unfortunately think that she had a low level and they're not. You know, sometimes you find insects don't thrive as much as you expect, and that would also delay this kind of population explosion. But her option, even though this might be quite a challenge, you know, insecticidal soap is a very good product, but you need good coverage, and you need to be persistent. It's about every 2 weeks with a maximum, or at least a minimum, of at least 3 treatments, because there are life stages you do not kill with the soap. So you have to keep on bleeding after them and going after them to really get a chance of getting the population down and giving the plant a chance.
Are you on so I can ask another question?
Sure.
I mean, am I on?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, because my question is, because I used to work in a greenhouse for many years and in a greenhouse where we specialized in houseplants, and I have a degree in biology, took botany in college, so I knew that it was beyond treatment, So I put it in a plastic bag and we disposed of it.
Mm-hmm.
But with my specimen plants that I brought in, and even though, you know, I probably barely touched anything, and because mine are so beautiful and so perfect, I was wondering if I should go ahead and use the insecticide granules in my soil just for protection. Mm-hmm. And then I know it's stinky and I know it's not the best option, but my ficus tree, my things are large.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking maybe a systemic and then go ahead and repot this next spring. What would you think of that?
Well, you know, there are systemics available. The better ones right now are these neonicotinoids, you know, that you get. And one of the advantages is they're not as toxic as the old systemics are to people. What they do is they'll move through the tree, and it makes it much easier to treat a large tree like a ficus with that. But the limitation is that it will not eliminate a population if the scales or other creatures are down on older woody tissue. They don't get as much chemical to them. So if a tree was already infested, we kind of tell people you can treat with it. It will keep it on hold. It will never eliminate it. Now, in your case, you're using it more as a preventative. And so putting it on once with the small probability that a couple critters somehow got to your trees, then it's got a chance because, as I said, most critters are not going to be on the older tissue. They're going to be the young, actively growing tissue, and that's where the systemics tend to shine. And one of the advantages also is many of those products will last 60 days plus in one treatment, so it's not like you got to treat multiple times. But as I said, the one limitation on older woody tissues and whatnot, they don't move as well, and so that's why it's a partial fix is the best way to put it. So it's kind of a personal decision. You know, if it would help for your peace of mind because you've got such valuable plants, I see nothing wrong with it. But I would just treat them once, you know. And again, There's various products, but most of those will be, Bayer has some systemic, even little capsules that you put in, and depending on the size of the pot, will tell you how many capsules to put in. Just do your normal watering, and then the plant will move it through on its own.
There you go. Good luck, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. And actually, you were mentioning
Neonicotinoids?
Neonicotinoids. Right. And Lori in Stillwater, Minnesota, I think, has something relating to that. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
And what's on your mind?
Well, I appreciate your show as usual, and I'm calling because I am the pollinator-friendly organizer in Stillwater, Minnesota, and I often listen to Wisconsin Public Radio because I get it in clear here.
Great.
I wanted to mention that I know it's come up on the show before, but the public really needs to be educated about neonicotinoids and often the chemicals that people purchase to kill these beautiful pollinator insects that we have, including wasps and any kind of bee and butterflies and invertebrates as well, are dying off permanently because of the use of these neonicotinoids. So I don't think the public knows about the extensive use of these, including plants when they're purchased from greenhouses, and in particular plants that don't belong here in terms of their natural habitat are completely drenched with the neonicotinoids. So I'm just going to say that much, and I'm sure you're...
I'm sure Phil has a comment, Phil?
Well, a couple things. It's interesting. Those products are going through an EPA review right now, and far more use agriculturally than they are. You know, most of the products that you buy at the local garden stores are not neonicotinoids. The only products basically are some of these systemic products, some of the rose products that are available. And one of the interesting things is that the way they work in different plants is not always predictable. One of the things that make them less of a concern is that they generally don't translocate near as well into reproductive tissue. And so, to be honest, some of these products have registration on fruits and vegetables, believe it or not. And if you follow the normal recommendations, so it's a complicated subject. There's no question that you don't want bees and wasps and other things exposed to these things. You know, one of the biggest mistakes homeowners make at times is to spray plants in bloom, which is against the law. You know, and it's just common sense. If you've got pollinators in there, and we use even non-nicotinoids, you're using insecticides other than maybe insecticidal soap, it has toxicity, and that's why you don't spray blooming plants. But as I had mentioned, you know, a tropical plant like the ficus, there's just no bee exposure there. You know, the bees, there's nothing flowering, there's nothing that the bees get exposed. So there are potential uses that have far less risk, and you have to weigh that in individual situations. And as I said, one would suspect that when the EPA review comes about, there will be a curtailing in the use of these products. I don't think they will be banned, but I think their uses will be limited considerably. And a lot of it has to do with pollinator protection and concerns therein, groundwater, and there's a few other things involved with it. So, as I said, I'm glad you brought it up. You know, the whole pollinator issue is a very broad issue. You know, I tend to concentrate on bees since they are such an important part of the group. We have over 400 species of native bees in our state, and although pesticides are an issue, by far a bigger issue has been habitat issues, where, you know, the kind of places that they need to raise their young and live are getting to be few and far between, and so that's an important consideration, too.
Thanks, Lori, for calling. Brian in Dorchester, thank you for calling. Hi.
All right, Dorchester. Part of my job is to mow roadside ditches, and of course, I clip off a lot of milkweeds, and I was just wondering, is there a better time of year to do that mowing?
Oh, when do they eat the milk?
Well, you know, the butterflies get up here sometimes as early as May, when sometimes it's kind of few and far between to find plants. Generally, the later you go in the summer, the more likely you are to have active caterpillars and the like. So it gets to be quite a dilemma, because I'm sure that's when the plants are needing to be mowed the worst. You know, at this time of the year now, we're getting to the point that it's pretty much the breeding and whatnot is over, and we're just seeing things migrate through. So at times, if you can delay until you get well into September, you'll have less of an impact.
Yeah.
They do grow back quite quickly. They pop right up again, the milkweed.
Yeah. And as long as it's there, it's just that the caterpillars that would be present when you mowed probably would have kind of a tough time of it.
And what part of the milkweed do they eat?
Leaves.
Just the leaves.
Yeah, and it's interesting. They're concentrating products when they eat that protect them from predators. There's a very interesting association there. But it has to be in the milkweed family. So swamp milkweed, butterfly weed, and common milkweed are probably by far the three most important plants for them in our area.
Yeah.
So when the milkweed grows back, it doesn't really mature. But
that's fine. Yeah, as long as the butterfly, if she lays her eggs after you go through and the plants are regrowing, caterpillars will do just fine.
Oh.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a Facebook question from Kathy. I live just south of Rhinelander. I have two green chrysalis on a bush by my house. They formed 1 week before Labor Day. It's been too cold for them, I think. Are they goners, or is there something I can do to save them?
Well, try to keep them in as warm an environment to try to get them out. I would think with the weather this week in Wisconsin, if you had some adults, it would be very fair to let them go and let them go, or take a drive to Madison, bring them south a little bit, save them a couple hundred miles. But no, as I said, I think there's still enough time frame left in the next 2 or 3 weeks if you can get those adults pushing. But boy, they should be pushing by now, I would think.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. News is next. No matter what the season, there are countless insects around us at all times, and whether you're talking about wasps or butterflies or Japanese beetles or spiders, it's always fascinating and fun to talk about. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we visit with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He's our guide to the world of insects, helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. And Phil, always great to have you with us. Thanks for coming by.
Nice to be here.
And boy, I tell you what, we've been going over my Facebook page. Tons of photos. We got one. What's this one here from? I'm trying to see who this is from. Might be from James. Mm-hmm. In the early summer, these beetles were eating my milkweed.
So there turns out to be three species of bright red longhorn wood boring beetles. So the family is basically a dead tree type of creature, but there are these three species on milkweed. And you tell the difference between the spots and bands are, you know, how big they are and the like.
Yeah.
The adults feed on the foliage. The grubs feed down on the stems and roots, but really don't cause a lot of problems. And so oftentimes the question is, are these competitors against milkweed or monarchs? And I find it not.
No.
You know, there's plenty of milkweed to go around. They're kind of an interesting critter on themselves. They're brightly colored because, like the monarch, they are sequestering chemicals from the plant, which protect them against predators. So they advertise, here I am, leave me alone. So it's kind of fun. And as I said, it's a fun family. And what's as interesting is normally you associate them with different species of woody trees. But this particular genus is associated with milkweed.
Gary in Minocqua has a question. Hi, Gary. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you all about a carpenter ant infestation that we had in the past. With the help of your guest, we actually were able to track it down. It started with seeing some sawdust-like material outside electrical outlets. We ultimately found that we had a leak in the house creating softwood, water damage, got it repaired. The question is, how likely is it that there would be a nest of these critters that we didn't get at? We did find some of this sawdust material outside an electric outlet some distance from where we found the original leak and most of this damage.
Did they replace the wood that was damaged?
Well, yes and no. Part of it yes, part of it no.
Okay.
We did treat it with insecticide through the outlet covers on the inside. Some of the wood on the outside was torn out and replaced. My guess is that there are parts of it that were still left in place, although I do believe it's mostly dry now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know what? They're looking for something that's already soft. So the water issue, although as we know, water over time will soften more wood, you can still have activity. It's going to be a wait and see, honestly. I think the things that will show you that you kind of didn't get them is if ants show up anytime from January until maybe about the 1st of May, because that activity is too early to be from outside active ants, and that would suggest a nest indoors. Or if you see more debris at any time, you know, coming through. But it's, you know, what makes it tough is there are carpenter ants on everybody's property. You know, if you've got trees around, you've got carpenter ants nesting out in the trees. And in the summer when they show up in the kitchen, more likely it's just worker ants from those trees coming in looking for food. It's the pattern and activity at other times of the year that doesn't fit that, that would suggest you still got activity. And, you know, sometimes when you replace the wood, you see right where they are. I see the ants. The other thing is when you have things opened up, that's often the best time to treat because you can get access to where the nests are. And so sometimes, you know, when somebody's re-roofing and they see where there's been some activity, it's worth treating that spot at the time. But it is going to be just kind of a wait and see what the activity is. And just see, because you see a black ant in the middle of summer, don't get nervous. But if you see any black ant activity, and what you'll tend to find in February, March, if you see activity, they won't be interested in food. They'll be interested in water. And what they're doing is bringing water back to get the humidity up back in the nest so they can start raising young.
And so when you say February, March, obviously it's inside the house.
Yes, definitely.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Gary. John in Mason. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah. I have two questions. One is that I read somewhere that if you leave a paper wasp nest up after you've sprayed the nest and killed the inhabitants, that wasps are territorial and they will leave that area. They won't make another nest. They won't re-inhabit that nest. So I left a nest up above my door, and I've never had a problem with bees there. Mm. And my second question, well, my first question is that true that they are territorial and won't bother if they find a nest? And my second question is, my sister has army or tent worms at her house, and the webbing is jam-packed full of little critters.
And she's seeing that now?
Yeah, and some of them are up high in a tree where you can't reach.
Okay, sure.
And I was wondering, would wasp spray that sprays like 15, 20 feet, if you drench that nest with wasp killer, would that kill the army worms?
Yes, but it's not worth it. And what she has is fall webworm. At this time of the year, the critters up in the trees are fall webworm. The damage is cosmetic. The trees are going to drop leaves, and I got to believe they're done feeding. You can still have a lot of frass and debris in those webbings, but it's not an insect that's worth messing with other than, you know, if one's 3 feet off the ground and you can clip it out with the hedge clippers, that's fine. But, as I said, it looks a heck of a lot worse than it is. And as I said, considering the lateness of the year, it's not worth treating for it. Now, you know, I do know they even sell fake wasp nests for that purpose of being territorial. And I have not had a chance to ask my colleague Bob Jean, who is a wasp expert, about this. But what my guess is that if there was a nest there, the workers would be aggressive to keep other workers away. So, yes, they are territorial, but it's because the workers are pushing the other kind of workers from establishing. It's not the presence of the nest. And so, nothing wrong with leaving the nest there.
No.
In fact, I have a great big nest, and they're great conversation piece, especially, in fact, you'll see some of these huge nests that you get bigger than basketballs at times in local bars and whatnot. They make a nice thing to talk about. But as far as I'm aware of, they said if you don't have active wasp defending the territory, I suspect that it's not going to work.
And Barbara actually sent us a photo on my Facebook page of a nest that's in their eaves. She said somebody strongly objected to leaving it there and said, you should get rid of it.
No,
and
see,
she said no.
Yes, I mean, the risk to me is that, you know, you go up there and try to deal with it and you risk getting stung. And as we had mentioned earlier, many of these things are very important predators. And so as long as they're in a place that doesn't bother people, why take the risk of bothering with them? Plus, there's argument that they're going to die out naturally in 3 weeks anyway. So why do it? I remember, as I'm pondering writing this book of all the funny things I used to hear in the lab, one of the funniest things I remember is talking to a gentleman who was talking about this great big wasp nest sitting on top of a overhanging light in their street. So it's up there 20 feet. And as we're talking, I hear a boom, and he goes, oh, my goodness, and then proceeds to tell me the neighbor came out with a 410 and thought that that was the solution to shoot it. So, of course, what happened is it blew up, and all the kids that were watching are getting stung because there was lots of angry wasps. And so sometimes people don't think these through. And as I said, my advice would have been, why bother with it?
Yeah.
Again, when my colleague Bob Jean and his students were working, they literally would take small bald-faced hornet nests, bring it into a garden and observe, and it absolutely was extremely effective at taking care of the cabbage worms and all the other little caterpillars out in the garden because these things were preying upon those things. And so, as I said, they definitely do have a beneficial side. You just, unfortunately, can't have a nest 3 feet from your front door because they just aren't going to tolerate the activity there, and then people will get stung.
Cesar in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I got a question about scorpions.
Scorpions.
Okay, so that's an interesting one because they're not native here. I've only seen scorpions about four times in my career being an issue. So are they big, long scorpions like you see with the big, big tail that they sting with, or are these much smaller creatures with little scorpion-like?
No. They're the ones that sting. My youngest daughter got sting, and they seem to be getting into the house. And I was wondering, is there anything I can put on so that they don't get in? Because we've already actually found six of them.
Big are they? How long are they?
About an inch and a half or 2 inches.
Okay. I really would love to see a specimen of that because, again, I go back. The closest that native scorpions get is Kentucky. And I have seen scorpions on ship products from other places, and then we run into issues, and they're a very long-lived creature. So if one came in a box into your house, they could be there around for a while. But there's no way I'd expect them migrating from outside because you just don't see them here.
Yeah.
So you can consider if there's a couple running around in the house, as I said, it's going to take them a time to die out on their own, so... they would respond to ant sprays. The other thing you can consider using, you know, scorpions like to hide underneath things. And they sell these glue boards. It's just a tacky piece of cardboard that if they crawled on, they would get stuck on. And you can put that underneath a refrigerator or underneath a chair. In some of these places, they might be. Now, the good news generally is even though the movies tell us that, you know, you die from scorpion stings, you don't. But it's a very unpleasant experience. And as I said, I would sit back and try to think, did you receive any goods, items from other people? Because it's just not a creature that you find in this state, as I said, other than in shipped goods.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
You know, down in Arizona and the like, what they'll tend to do because they migrate in from outside, it's like we do for box elder bugs and stuff. You seal things so that they can't find their way up as much as possible. You know, and it's an interesting cultural thing. And people in Arizona, every time they in the morning when they wake up, they shake out their shoes because there could be a scorpion hiding in it, which is that the last thing you think about if you grew up in Wisconsin because it isn't going to happen.
Danielle in Cornucopia. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, so one of my favorite things to do in the summer up in the Bayfield Peninsula is pick berries and both wild and on the farms. And the farmers have been talking about the newish fruit fly, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Drosophila.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you guys could speak to that a little bit and just a little education and what we can do about it or going on with that.
Well, you know, I will confess its exact status right now, you know, being retired now for 7 months, I haven't paid as much attention as I did when I was running the lab. But to give you some overview, the spotted-winged Drosophila is a Japanese species that's been in the state now for about 3 years. And although it can feed on many thin-skinned fruit, where we have seen not much in blueberries in the state, more problems in fall raspberries has been the big crop, not seen much activity in grapes and the like, and... you know, our first question was, could it spend the winter? And my colleague, Christelle Goudot, who is our extension fruit entomologist, and her students found, yes, it could. So, you know, it's here to stay is kind of where we're at.
Right.
And the unfortunate part of it then is because fruit flies can breed on all these wild hosts like things like, well, again, any thin-skinned berry. So we find honeysuckle berries and the like. So they're probably breeding, but we don't see the activity till about the middle of July. So anything that's starting to fruit at that time that's susceptible has to be protected, unfortunately. And, you know, there are organic sprays. There's all kinds of ways, but it becomes a high-maintenance issue. And there just doesn't seem to be any other way around it that, again, our late summer thin-skinned fruit crops are going to have a problem. We thankfully found out they don't mess with cranberries, so that was one potential headache we didn't have to deal with. But as I said, the fall raspberry crop has particularly been hit. And what convinced us last year is when it hit statewide the same day. Which the only way you can make that argument is they have spent the winter. Whereas when we saw our first exposure to it, we wondered, well, maybe they blew in with the winds because they had been seeing them in states around us, but it was a relatively new problem. But as I said, now we know for sure that they're here. But it's interesting, as I said, being retired, you don't pay as much attention. But we haven't been overwhelmed from what I know. But if you were trying to keep updated, as I said, if you go to the Department of Entomology, and go under extension and fruit crop person. Christelle, I know, gives updates on a regular basis because she's got traps out and other things, and she's been working with growers on various techniques. But the bottom line is it seems to come to because they can blow in small areas, but move around the way they do is you have to protect them before they get in the fruit. Once they get in there, you've kind of lost the battle.
Mm, there you go. Good luck, Danielle. Thank you very much for calling.
So what makes this unique, Larry, is that when they lay their eggs, it's when the fruit's just starting to color. It can even be green. So you pick it, it's already infested. Whereas typically you associate fruit flies with stuff that's overly ripe and damaged. And so it's kind of a whole new game changer as far as fruit flies in this state.
We have, you know, Cesar called earlier about scorpions, but Donna called in and said, hey, I wonder if it's earwigs. And that would make very good guess,
I think. The good news is earwigs, although they can pinch a little bit, don't have a true stinger, you know, whereas scorpions have this little venom sac and a little needle-like device that when they get you, so in some sense, it's kind of like a bee sting as far as what they're trying to do. And that would make more sense because earwigs, of course, have been in the state for about 35, 40 years now. And they rear back like a scorpion.
Yeah.
They do come indoors, but it's a dead end for them indoors. They can't breed indoors. Our earwig species is the European earwig. One generation a year tends to mature in the middle of summer, and then they do wander in. They're mostly active at night. So for that one, again, much like we talked about, is try to figure out where they might be squeezing in. And you know, every time we do this show, we talk about the weakness of most of our homes is where the siding meets the foundation. There's a spacing that millipedes and scorpions and ants and you name it can crawl up into. And so you often find if you go through the hands and knees effort of sealing those things up, many of these nuisance insect problems are improved dramatically. And you've got a semi-permanent solution versus when you spray the outside foundation, it lasts for a few days to a few weeks at best, and then you have to reapply it.
Yeah. Donna, thanks. Donna Watzer phoned that in. She has been with us many times on the show. She's talking about, she knows all about poisons and all those little household things.
Donna and I have had some good conversations back when my kids were small. We had to call poison control more than once. So,
Donna, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Chris in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I've got a recurring issue. I don't know what it is. I haven't seen the bug, but we've got a 100-year-old home, and it's a limestone block and mortar foundation. What I'm seeing is there's holes that are burrowed into the mortar, and then a pile of sand or dust or whatever is left next to the foundation. There's no critter living in there, and I haven't seen anything flying in or out. I'm wondering if you think you might know. I'm thinking maybe carpenter bees, or I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's anything I can spray on the foundation to keep things from burrowing into it.
Well, one of the things is if they're getting through the mortar has to be starting to degrade because I just don't know any insect that's got tough enough jaws to be able to go into sound mortar. I mean, that's like burrowing to rock, and we just don't see that. So Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there's any evidence. You know, I was thinking of cave crickets messing around in there. If everything seems uniform, that more likely would be something like a carpenter bee. I mean, what they do for some things is, you know, if there was a hole that was active, then you'd dust something in there and that would take care of it. If you're looking more for some kind of protectant, again, what you'll find at most of the hardware stores and the like are pyrethroid insecticides made for spraying on houses. And you, if you applied it, if there was a seasonality to this, like it seemed to happen in the middle of July, you spray that. Although, you know, what you find is what you buy at the hardware store is somewhat different. It's the same chemical, but a different formulation than what a pest control service would use. The difference is many of the things that they're putting, the pest control people use, are microencapsulated, which is a way of formulating the stuff that both makes it a little bit safer to use, but lasts quite a bit longer, because it's almost as if the insecticides are impregnated in these little plastic balls. And so when you put it on a surface, it extends the life of the product considerably. So those products are available to you. They're not restricted use, but they don't sell them at the local hardware store. You'd have to go on the internet to buy them. And so you go under Do Your Own Pest Control and you can see some of those products. So if I were to suggest something, I think you get more bang for the buck by using the microencapsulated formulations, because they'll hold up so much better, especially against that surface. Because if you use a liquid, I think it's going to just get soaked in like a sponge, and that's not what you want. You want something that's going to kind of coat, and that's the advantage of these microencapsulated type products.
Okay, and that was what was the name of that, those products again?
You'll see, they're all pyrethroids. You know, Demand, Suspend are two commercial names. There's a number of other products out there.
Okay.
So
there you go.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Ron in La Crosse, you have a quick question.
Yeah, I'll try to make it quick. Maybe that scorpion sighting was a pseudoscorpion.
Well, that's why I was asking about the size, you know, in that inch and a half is way too big. Now, the more common thing, pseudoscorpions are about the size of your small little fingernail. They've got the great big front chelicerae or pincers that look like a scorpion, but they're round, so they kind of look like a tick to me with these things. And
my call I had a bed bug problem. I moved into a place 6 months ago and started getting bites, 10 times the size of mosquito bites, 5 times as itchy, and they last 2 weeks, bunches of them. And I did my research and went off-label using a fungal insecticide naturally occurring in soil, an organic pesticide called Bovaria bassiana. After a couple treatments, it seems to work, knocks them down. Otherwise, I guess after that, I see you could rent maybe a barn heater for $30 and turn the temperature of your place up to 150 degrees, which probably kill everything. But I didn't want to wait for a long time for everything.
Yeah. Now, Bavaria, you know, as you said, I can't suggest it because it's not on the label. And if you do things other than what the label, but in order for Bavaria to work, it needs high humidity. It's a naturally occurring fungus disease. It's what kills box elder bugs in wet years and why we don't have problems in wet years and the like. And there are formulations used in the greenhouse for killing various insects. That's a very interesting use of it. Normally, I wouldn't think there's enough humidity in a house to make the Bavaria work. But if this gentleman's had success, it's an interesting treatment.
That's for sure. Ron, thanks. We are out of time. Phil, thank you so much. Look forward to another visit.
We'll be here in another month. Yep.
All right. Wonderful. Phil Pelletieri, our resident entomologist, will be back with us in a month, and we'll do this all over again. Tomorrow at 11, we'll visit with Wisconsin author Chloe Krug about her fascinating novel called The Anatomy of Dreams. Then at 11:45, how to cook and enjoy brassicas like kale and cabbage and Brussels sprouts and radishes. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.